Welcome, this is James Corbett, and you're tuned into CorbettReport.com on what is the 12th day of October 2011 here in Japan, and today I'm talking to Christopher Porter, the leader of the Canadian Action Party, who listeners might remember from interview number 381 recorded last week, and we're also joined on the line by Lawrence McCurry, an independent journalist from Canada at CanadaAwakes.blogspot.com. So gentlemen, thank you for joining us today on the Corbett Report.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, James.
All right, let's start with Lawrence. It's your first time on the Corbett Report, so perhaps you can introduce yourself and a little bit about your work.
Well, I'm a writer and activist here in Toronto. I do have some affiliations with the Canadian Action Party, and just general all-around troublemaker here in Ontario. I covered the G20 protests last year, which got covered quite a bit. I've done some work with Dan Dix and Press for Truth. And what we're talking about tonight is the upcoming Occupy protests that are taking place in Canada this coming Saturday.
That's right. And I guess things are probably turning chilly there, so it'll be interesting to see how this really develops in Canada. But let's go over to Christopher, because I understand you were attending an organizational meeting, a pre-meeting for the Occupy Victoria protests. Tell us a little bit about what you saw.
Yeah, it was very interesting. It was at the third or I think their third pre-meeting before the actual date, which is quite interesting how they've been able to get so organized. And while we're all meeting and talking about consensus and awakening the democratic process, some people started voicing their small little concerns about media and police presence, et cetera, et cetera. And I lived 10 years in the South Pacific, and in the South Pacific, they use consensus in their village life. So I'm well accustomed to what consensus is. And consensus is 100% agreement. Now, it does take some time and some work to get to that point, but consensus does involve getting to that point. And two points that were brought up in the meeting in Occupy Victoria was, one, the acceptance that the police are probably infiltrated in the group and probably present at all meetings and in an undercover status, as well as the media would have all opportunity to film and record however they see fit. Now, when you're talking about a meeting that is supposed to be working on consensus, I raised up concerns and said, well, why can't we simply discuss this and talk about this and ask these questions? And quickly was surprised to see, well, no, we're going to continue with there's only a few of you abstaining or in dissent, so we're going to continue on this. And it was a shock to me that this hope and this view of Occupy date on October 15th could be sidetracked here. And then I started talking to some other people in Edmonton and Vancouver and Lawrence in Toronto and saw that this was happening in other places, and just want to talk about this before this event so that that people that are going to go participate here for the right cause truly stand up and do attend, because a lot of people now are saying, oh, I don't want to attend, and that's not the right answer here.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I attended the first organizational meeting of Occupy Toronto in Burnsy Park last Friday. It was well attended. There was a good 150, maybe 200 people show up for this meeting. But there were a lot of things that happened at this meeting that raised my suspicions. For starters, the people that were organizing this meeting, I've never seen before. I go out to a lot of protests here in Toronto. I cover a lot of actions. I know all the hardcore activists, if not by name, by sight. And the people that were organizing this meeting in Toronto, I have never seen before. I've never seen them at an anti-war protest. I've never seen them at any of the G20 actions, nothing. And it seemed that right from the start, they took control of the meeting. It was a very short time before they had like 150 people sitting on the grass waving their hands instead of applauding and doing the mic check thing where you got the whole crowd repeating what the speaker is saying. If they just raised their voice, I'm sure that wouldn't have been necessary. Or if somebody had a thought of bringing a bullhorn. One of the reasons why we don't see a bullhorn at the New York protests is because they're illegal in New York City. But there's no law against it in Toronto, so it amazes me that somebody didn't bring a bullhorn to this meeting. But there were a few things that actually caught my attention. One of them was that one of the organizers, and this was right at the beginning of the meeting too, had got up there and announced that he'd been in contact with both the Toronto Police Service as well as CSIS. And it was at that point that the crowd sort of turned on these people. And right away, they backed off from that altogether. The guy apologized for it and said, okay, well, I got no right talking to the Secret Service about what's going on here. Also, their point man for media relations is a gentleman by the name of Batty, Batty. Now, he'd given an interview with the CBC earlier this week in relation to this Occupy Toronto protest, and I couldn't believe he was talking about the same protest. Either he's very uneducated in what the issues are here in Canada, which I've got to say a large portion of the crowd was too, but it seems that there's all kinds of issues that people are bringing up that are sidetracking this whole protest. You know, in my opinion, what this is about is fractional reserve banking and going back to using the Bank of Canada, which is a public bank in Canada. It's owned by the people. Right now, our money is created through private banks, just the way the Federal Reserve in the United States is a private bank. It's the private banking institutions in Canada that actually create our money and have been doing so since the 70s. Chris could probably tell you more about this than I could. But it seems to me that the people organizing this are more into running this little organization that they've got going, even to the point of asking for donations, than they are in addressing the issues. And, you know, I'm starting to see stuff coming out on Facebook that's being put out by this organization where they want to have media seminars and they're putting out guidelines for language so that, you know, there's no hate language. And as a writer, it just sort of gets my hackles up when somebody tries to dictate what kind of words a person is going to use to express their ideas or their feelings. And that smacks of censorship to me.
Well, that's extremely interesting. You both bring up in different ways, I think, the idea or at least the specter of infiltration in this movement. And to me, that's a very important point because it raises, I mean, the question of during a consensus process, how easy is it to derail the conversation? I mean, all you need is one person to dissent from anything and you have to wait for that person. I mean, it's extremely easy occupation to infiltrate, isn't it?
Well, that's what I was surprised at, was that here I am being one of the only ones dissenting to saying, hey, I don't accept that the police should be allowed to infiltrate here and profit by being here by working. If they're working, they're getting paid and they're being at a public institution that's having a meeting to decide how they were going to voice best the concerns of the people because we're not being listened to. And by freely admitting that we're probably have mass amounts of police intermingled with us and that we don't have the right to ask if that's true and if so, what are the intentions? That's where I start saying, well, yes, it can be very easily infiltrated to the point where they're giving you warnings that it's actually happening. And my shock and amazement was that I and just two other individuals liberals were the only ones opposed to this type of structure of freely allowing this to happen. And so tomorrow there's another meeting, and some of us are going to do exactly that and say, you know, if you're truly talking about the consensus, then let's talk about consensus. We have concerns and let's address them, because if not, then we're not really working on consensus. And basically, we're just talking about creating another system of majority representation. And we already know where that's left us.
Well, the obvious question then is, how do you actually stop such infiltration in a movement like this?
Well, I don't think you can stop it. Being in Toronto, you know that we went through the G20 last year. So people are very ill at ease on how the police are going to react to this. Frankly, I don't think we should be dealing with the police at all, period. For the simple reason that the police are going to do what the police are going to do. And if they decide they're gonna club protesters and have mass arrests, that's what they're going to do, no matter what kind of sweetheart side deal the organizers may have made with them. But there's not a lot of trust for the police department here, period. There's also been a lot of talk about, oh, what do we do if the Black Bloc show up? Well, most of the hardcore activists here in Toronto are pretty well convinced at this point that the Black Bloc activists are controlled by the police department. If not Toronto police, then certainly CSIS.
I think that's right. I think it's pretty much inevitable at this point that the police-controlled Black Bloc movement is going to show up at some point to start causing troubles. I mean, I see that as the eventual way that this is going to play out, and it is a question of how people are going to deal with it when it does happen.
And I think that's why it's important to talk about it before the events happen. So people start saying, you know, this is a possibility. Here's the signs of how it can happen. And for me, it's the shock of a populace being quiet to say, well, we're comfortable if the police are infiltrated here. And I'm not comfortable if they're here and if they're not willing to stand up to say they are, because actions can mistakenly get viewed at different perceptions. And I have a current case with the Attorney General on such a subject for the rights of Canadians to defend themselves. This is some serious issues that the populace through this Occupy movement has an opportunity to challenge and has an opportunity to raise some questions. And we have to stop being scared to asking questions. We can't get in trouble if you're asking a question, but that's where it seems to be. And it's a shock to see it at such a level where you are in the sleepy town of Victoria, having 300-400 people show up to this type of meeting and then watching it just turn into a farce.
Right. Well, Christopher Lawrence talks about the relationship of the protesters there to the Toronto police, obviously in the wake of the G20 being pretty abysmal. How about in Victoria? What's the general sense of the police there?
The police have gone, the reputation has failed a bit here. They've been very rough with a couple arrests recently, and in across BC, some RCMP officers. We had the Polish immigrant at the airport that ended up getting tasered and killed. We had a 12-year-old child tasered up in the interior of British Columbia here. A lot of mistrust is occurring now, because of the amount of force being used. And I would never have imagined that I lived in a country that had gotten to this state where you would have to be worried about, you know, look at our history with someone was just talking about what was Bullwinkle's sidekick there, the officer. No, that was the Mountie. And now we've gone from the Mountie that's nice and friendly to RoboCop and being worried about who's pulling the strings. So people need to become more aware and challenge these questions so that, you know, I'm happy if the police are there, if they're telling us they're there and this is what they're concerned at and making sure that everything's happening, but not this infiltrating and just in case something's going to happen. That just puts everyone more at fear, puts everyone more mistrust. And those that are angry, it makes them angrier. And that's what we need to direct that anger to something positive so we can influence some change and try to get these regular groups to address these issues before they become the problems of the G20.
Well, I think a big part of the problem is that the people that are organizing these actions in Toronto seem to be making an awful lot of arbitrary decisions when it comes to dealing with the media and the police departments. Particularly the media, I find distressing. The person who's in charge of the media here in Toronto, you know, he wasn't elected to that position. He's not a very good speaker at all. He's already demonstrated on the CBC that he's got a very lacking knowledge of what this protest is really all about. And I wonder if that's not on purpose. You know, I'm starting to think that this protest, at least in Canada, has been organized by some people that want to put a particular spin to it in the media. I don't think the people of Toronto have any more trust in the mainstream corporate media than we do in our police department. You know, and this is all a problem. And to me, this all comes back to the banking issue. You know, we're dancing around the really big question here, and you know, the elephant in the room is, has democracy been hijacked by big banking and super corporations? Well, I don't think there's any question in anybody's mind that democracy is a sham in most of the free world, not only in Canada, but the United States, Australia, New Zealand, just about everywhere. These politicians are selected to you know, be in the positions that they're in, and politics is completely controlled. And nobody's talking about that. You know, nobody's talking about how the bankers and the corporations and the politicians are all the same people, basically. I mean, if you look at Canada, for example, 99% of the population don't realize that every prime minister we've had since Lester B. Pearson have all worked for the same guy in the same corporation, with the exception of one, which was Joe Clark. And, I mean, he was prime minister for, what, less than 6 months, right? But every other prime minister we've had since Lester B. Pearson have all been employees of a Paul DeMartin Power Corporation. Brian Mulroney sits on the board of directors of Power Corporation right now. Paul Martin got his shipping company from Power Corp. Jean Chrétien's daughter married into the family.
It is so ridiculous on its face, isn't it?
Exactly. Who's really running? And not only prime ministers, but a lot of the cabinet ministers and the provincial premiers are all selected by Power Corp, both liberal and conservative. You know, they sort of make it like it's a two-party thing going on here, with the NDP being the joke and nobody else exists. And the media is guilty in this as well. It was under Brian Mulroney that the media ownership laws in Canada were changed. At one time, we had laws in Canada that said you couldn't own more than one television station, newspaper, or radio in the same market. You know, well, that changed under Brian Mulroney, so what happened now? Well, now we've got three people that control the entire media right across the country. You know, I've seen it to the point to where they've even wiped out the little co-op radio stations. The CRTC is trying to yank the license on university stations like CKLN right now. And basically, you've got three people that control the entire media right across this country, except for people like James and, you know, Dan Dix at Press for Truth and a handful of other alternative media that are available through the web, Russian television. So the question is not only do we have to stop this fractional reserve banking system and go back to using the Bank of Canada, but we also have to do something about our corrupt political systems, and not only in Canada, but across the free world.
And that's the shock, is at these meetings in Victoria, it was a 2.5-3 hour meeting, any of these issues, and dealing with, to be honest, church directions. Don't say this, don't do this, sit here, stay there. Whoa, you know, that's a thought we're talking. Yeah.
A lot of that. You know, this is the hand sign you make if you approve, and this is the hand sign you make if you think the speaker's going on too long, and you know, when communicating with other people, you shouldn't use this kind of language. And it's like, whoa, hold on here a second. You know, am I in kindergarten? Now they're telling me, you know, to put up my hand to go to the bathroom and how to speak to people. This is crazy. This is insane. Not once at the organizational meeting did anybody discuss any of the topics that I just brought up. And as a matter of fact, at one point I had a small group of people gathering around me when I was talking about the banking policies of the Canadian Action Party. They were, you know, they all seemed to be very aware of the Federal Reserve and, you know, the problems with the American economic system, but not one of them had a clue as to how our economic system works here in Canada.
Well, this is very interesting, and it seems to me to indicate that, A, I think the way that these types of consensus processes will eventually play out is that the people who don't fit in with the whatever the main theme of these organizational meetings are will start their own groups. And B, I mean, isn't that the way that it should be? I mean, should we be trying to fight this organized, centralized structure of the government, media, financial nexus with another organized, centralized structure that's being dictated by very few who are setting the ground rules for the debate? I mean, isn't the point to have a spontaneous grassroots protest movement that doesn't go to the police and ask them for permission and doesn't have all of these organizational meetings telling people what they can and can't say, but is just genuinely a response of the people to the oppression that they're feeling?
Exactly, James. And that's why we're talking today, is to get the listeners to question when they're at these meetings and raise some of these issues up at these meetings. If they're going to play the game here with all consensus, then the meeting I just need four other people here to start blocking some stuff and changing the conversation here in the direction. So if we can start getting the organizers here to start talking about these serious issues and what Canadians can do to help the globalist agenda here to stop it, and why we need to, and what's happening and occurring, then we can use the Occupy event to something positive. But if we sit down here and get frustrated, that's my biggest concern, is talking to some people that are dedicated to the ultimate goal here and who are saying, no, I'm just not going to get involved. I'm not going to do anything on the 15th at the protest. And I think that's part of the design as well, is just to make you feel that it's going to be ineffective and keep some people at home. And we need to be there. We need to pass the message that we all know is true, and we need to remind people what the truth is.
Well, you know, I'd like to address that too. I've actually heard from a number of people that after attending the pre-organization meeting, you know, have said to me, oh, well, you know, this is controlled. I'm not going to get involved in something that's controlled. I'm not going. And, you know, my attitude towards that is no, you need to go. What we need to do is we all need to attend. And if this organization that's putting this thing together is not what we're looking for, ignore them. You know, we start our own discussion groups. And if they get in the way, you know, simply tell them, I don't recognize your authority on this. You know, this is not your protest. Go away.
Yeah, well, that's the shock too.
Tell them to hit the road and go with your own agenda. That's certainly what I've got intentions.
Well, this to me raises the question of who is organizing these organizational meetings? Who is running them? Who's the one who's actually speaking and giving these rules?
Yeah, that's what I was watching in Victoria. It was within 30 seconds hearing words called administrators, and Lawrence says in Toronto they call them facilitators, is all of a sudden you have administrators and facilitators that no one can determine how they were elected to that position. And that's quite alarming in that who is organizing and what is being organized. And is it actually just us thinking, wow, you guys, what are you doing? You're trying to organize the Democracy Party here. How can you have five meetings before the actual event worrying about planning bathrooms and first aid groups? You know, you're missing the whole point of what we're trying to talk about here.
I agree, absolutely. And, you know, it's so easy to hijack something like this, too. You know, you put out an announcement, we're all meeting in Burnsy Park on Friday afternoon, and, you know, 200 people show up. Well, you get up and you take control of that meeting, and you say, oh, well, you know, Batty here is good with the press. How about we make him Presley? Everybody put up your hands. You know, it's easy to hijack something like that because all of the people there don't know all the other people there. So, yeah. You know, like the sheep that people tend to be in these sort of things. Like, there, you know, I got to admit, there was one guy there who looked like the kind of guy who might have 50 cats at home, who did get up and fight these guys, you know. But eventually, you could tell that towards the end of the meeting, the facilitators or the organizers who took control of this, you know, pretty well pushed him out and ran through their own agenda. Now, they've gotten space at OISE, which you're familiar with, Chris, because that's where they held the alternative candidates debate here in Toronto that you attended. They've rented space in there, and throughout this whole week, they're having courses on, you know, a course for the medics and a course for the media people and, you know, a course for the, you know, a meeting of the organizational committee. And I'm thinking to myself, and not only that, they've already started collecting donations, both in money and goods.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, who are these people? Obviously, they've got a budget. Okay, it's apparent that they've got a budget of some kind. By the time of the first organizational meeting, they'd already had secured certain sponsors who requested to rename, you know, nameless, right? And right off the bat, I'm thinking to myself, whoa, wait a second here. You know, we've got people that are donating to this cause and they want to remain anonymous. Something's not tickety-boo here. And there's a whole list of things that facilitators have done, you know, that really make me suspicious of who they are, where their funding is coming from, and how is it that they just moved in and took over this whole movement, which, by the way, seemed to spring up in every major Canadian city, coordinated all for the same day at the same time. So whoever put this together has got people right across the country working on it.
It is extremely suspicious the way that this has cropped up, and there have been a lot of these types of things that have been tried in the past, and lots of different marches on different days and different times, with even coordinated marches all around the world, like we saw in the run-up to the Iraq War, with a million plus people all around the world going out on the streets protesting, and that barely got mentioned in the media. But these protests have sprung up very quickly and have been organized all around the world and are now getting a lot of attention. So it's very interesting the way this has played out, and it does raise my suspicion meter.
Oh, and not only that, these people are not forthcoming with the information. You know, I sent even before the meeting, before the first meeting, I sent a request to their media liaison, which they seem to have put together before this meeting was actually called, asking for information. They basically sent me back what was on the Facebook page. but didn't answer any of the questions about who they were and who's running this organization and how it was put together in the first place. So they're not forthcoming with the information, not only about their anonymous donors, but how they put this all together in the first place and how it magically happens in every other city across Canada. And again, I want to emphasize, just because the organizers or the facilitators, as they call themselves, of this action may have been co-opted, that's not a reason not to go. I think that makes it all that much more important that we do attend and do our own thing and ignore these people as much as possible.
Yeah, exactly, and that's why I'm going to go to attend the final general meeting before the October 15th, and I'm involved with the We Are Change group, and we're going to do our own thing on the ledge during the October 15th, and just try to bring more awareness to the banking issue. But what Lawrence is saying is, you know, we're talking about, you talk to all the cities across Canada, and you're talking same meeting dates, same agendas, same formats, same communications,
same type of facilitators.
Yeah, same type of facilitators, same, you know, literature, you know, like I'm a leader of a political party. I know how hard that is to accomplish. And we're talking just this has magically appeared in the last 20 days in Canada, across this nation, and we've been able to create this whole network of agreed consensus. It's, well, that's great if it's true. I don't think it is.
Well, there's a lot of questions that aren't being answered. Who put this together? Who's in charge of it? Who's putting the money up, you know, for the facilities? This is not coming from donations from some bakery or, you know, somebody who's a philanthropist that, you know, believes in the cause. There's definitely something fishy going on here. But at the same time, you know, I do support the whole idea of the Occupy movement. I think what's going on in New York, even though it may have originally been a co-opted protest, I think very quickly the people who attended took it over and, you know, ran it the way they thought it should be run.
That's what we need to do here in Canada, and that's why we wanted to talk tonight. Is that's what we need to do here in Canada, and not simply just give up and say, oh, it, and like Lawrence says, it's even more reason to attend, even more reason to observe, figure out what they're planning, and let us do our get the message across, because at every one of these occurrences, we can find 20, 30, 40 more people that understand the issues a bit better, and that's just going to help the ultimate end here.
Well, that's exactly what I've done. I've organized a small group of people that are going to help me out with what I consider to be our agenda, you know, and try to bring up the issues with as many people there as possible. And, you know, so I've already put together, you know, a handful of people that we've got our agenda on how we think this protest should go. And we're simply not going to allow these facilitators or this co-opted group to dictate to us what we can and cannot do at this action.
Okay, well, let's not leave that hanging then. Then what is, I mean, how should these protests go? What is the positive idea for what should be happening as opposed to what we see taking place?
Well, I've already had these facilitators send me an email. The Canada Action Party put forth a press release saying that we support the Occupy Wall Street movement and we support the Occupy the Canadian Cities movement. And what that did was have one of these facilitators send me a piece of email telling me, we don't recognize, officially, we don't recognize you and your political party. So, you know, my response to that was, that's fine. I don't recognize you either as the Occupy Toronto movement.
And James, to answer your question, it goes back what the original intent of Occupy Wall Street was, to hold these bankers and to hold these corporations accountable. That's all that CAP's been doing for all these years. That's all we want to see happen here. Now, it's such a big question, people want to shy away from it, but that's the question in the agenda of Occupy Wall Street, and it should be the question and mission of Occupy the Canadian citizens here. Let's get these bankers accountable. Explain why we're not using our Bank of Canada, our national bank here, for our better interest. We're slaves to debt across the world. We all know this, the struggle facing. No one has the answer here. And somehow out of all this mess, the bankers and the elite are still dictating which direction this country is going, to no betterment of the middle class and general Canadians. That's the questions we have to ask on the 15th and get answers.
Well, you know, in the long run, The mainstream corporate media is going to do what the media does. The police in Toronto are going to do what the police in Toronto are going to do. We've got no control over that either as individuals or as a group. I've actually heard rumors that Bill Blair tends to take the entire protest site and declare it a construction zone to move people out of it. All I could say to him is good luck with that. You know, I don't recognize Chief Blair any more than I recognize the facilitators for this protest. I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and I hope everybody else has that attitude about it as well.
Well, I would hope so, and I agree with everything that's being said, but again, I'm just wondering about the specifics. I mean, it is certainly true that we do need to hold the banksters and the politicians in their thrall to account for what they've done. And I think a lot of people are familiar, as you say, with the American version of that and talking about Goldman Sachs and their operations and the subprime mortgage market and all of those sorts of things in the Wall Street context. But in the Canadian context, I think a lot fewer people are familiar with it. It's not something that's reflected as much, even in the alternative media. And it raises the question of who, what politicians, what bankers, what banks, what specific practices are we talking about here? Or is it just overall reform of the system? And if so, in what sense are we demanding these reforms take place? Or who are we demanding them from? There's a lot of specifics that I think people would need to have on board before they get involved in something like this.
You know, William Krim, he's 94 years of age, from Comer.org, Committee on Monetary Economic Reform. He summarized it the best to me, is that no politician has the right to dictate the future of this country without understanding its past. And that's all we're talking about here, is going back and reviewing the past. And if I could quote here, the Prime Minister, who I still hold a lot of respect for, because he actually nationalized our Bank of Canada in 1938. And it was Minister William Lyon Mackenzie King. And this is a quote directly from him. "Once a nation parts with the control of its currency and credit, it matters not who makes the nation's laws. Usury, once in control, will wreck any nation. Until the control of the issue of currency and credit is restored to government and recognized as its most sacred responsibility, all talk of sovereignty, of parliament, and of democracy is futile." Now, that's some powerful words from 1938, and we need to reflect on that. We need to remind ourselves the history of the Bank of Canada, what it got us through, and the decisions since the 70s of the political elite changing those rules. And we're not talking about creating a new system. We're talking about reflecting. We still have the power under the Bank of Canada Act. We just don't have the will of the elected parliament to actually enforce it. And that's all we're talking about. And that is a specific goal that we have to educate more people on, that so they question it and they ask their MPs about it, and they say, is it true? Do we have a national bank? And what powers does the bank do? And why aren't we doing this? And let's start getting any answers. You know, I phoned the Bank of Canada here trying to get the specific date of our nationalization, which is August 15th, 1938, and actually have the documents of it being passed and everything. But on the phone with the Bank of Canada, the researcher said, well, I don't think it is nationalized, but don't quote me on that. You know, that's how far we're at. You know, we got to do some serious reminding here.
Well, no question. And I think our big role here is to educate the Canadian public on where our economy really is. You know, people have this view that economics is so complex that you have to have a master's in economics to really truly understand how the economy of Canada works. Well, frankly, that's simply not true. Every day, this country. What's the daily amount there, Christopher? Is it
165 million a day in interest?
Exactly. Every day, this country pays $165 million a day, only in interest on the deficit. Well, if that money had have been borrowed from the Bank of Canada, which is a publicly owned bank, it could lend the money to the government interest free. In other words, that deficit would be paid off in short order. Right now, what we're doing is we're borrowing that money, and the deficit being the amount of money that the government spends above what they collected in taxes and paid out in expenses. We could be borrowing that money debt-free from the Bank of Canada and pay off that deficit in short order. Instead, since the 70s, what the government in Canada has done is borrowed that money from private banking interest. Thus, we're paying $160 million a day in the interest payments alone. Now, who are these private bankers? Well, they're the Chartered Banks of Canada, the Royal Bank, the CIBC, the Bank of Montreal, the Toronto Dominion, which, of course, have ties with Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and the Rothschild banking interests in England. I mean, it's all interconnected. You know, when you're talking private banks, you're talking private banks. And you know, they're the same people. You could break them up into their, you know, their little organizations, but it's that 1% that have all the money. And when people are talking, I'm the 99%, you know, they're talking about everybody except the bankers and the people that own these large corporations that are really running the country. And there's so much money that is accumulated into such a small group of people that they've gotten to the point to where they're actually running the governments of the world. You know, when George Bush was talking about his new world order, well, what that new world order means is that the 1% that he's representing and that the Prime Minister of Canada and Australia and New Zealand and all these other countries are representing are going to screw their own people. You know, form this one world government and have a currency that's issued by this banking conglomerate. And I don't think that bodes well for the people of the world at all. And I think most of all, well, first we need to educate the population of Canada as to what the banking issues are here in Canada. And then, you know, do something about our corrupt government if they're not going to change it.
Well, I think it's important to reflect on those figures, because when we're talking about $165 million a day in interest to private bankers that by all rights the Canadian people shouldn't owe at all because they should be using the Bank of Canada to fund their infrastructure payments, it does, I mean, unfortunately these days perhaps we're desensitized to those types of numbers because we're used to hearing about the trillions and trillions and trillions involved in the American economy and all of the shenanigans going on there. But still, when we think about it in a Canadian economic context, I mean, that's a staggeringly large sum of money, and
billions of dollars every year.
Exactly. And we have that, with that much money being on the line, it's self-evident that there's going to be a great deal of resistance, one might say, to these types of grassroots movements. And I think that's why we can't trust that these movements in fact, we have to almost expect that they're going to be infiltrated. There's going to be all sorts of dirty tricks being played on this, because it's just too much, too important, too valuable for the banksters and the politicians and their thrall to leave to chance. And that, to me, raises the question of real, what is real revolution? How do we really achieve it? Is it going to be achieved by a bunch of people on the streets, or is there another way to do this? And if so, what is it?
I believe it's the knowledge will turn into passion. And, you know, you're right. People do get desensitized to the numbers and 165 million. Well, that sounds all right. You know, the States is in the trillions. But you have to get it down to a community level. And we have 308 riding associations. That's basically $500,000 for every riding, you know. And most Canadians understand their riding. It's not that much space. They can start putting it into perception. And that's what I would do to people during the election to get that passion to come out. And I said, we're talking about $500,000 a day here. So let's say 1 week, that's 3.5 million. Do you think the community of Victoria would have a project that 3.5 million could benefit itself with? Yes, of course. And if you cooperated with the neighboring community, you're now at 7 million. Do you think you could come up with a project in 1 week that would benefit for $7 million? Once people start getting that grasp that money's just getting out of their hands and all this struggle that they're facing is actually can be prevented, I think that education will turn into anger. That anger will be action, and then you will see serious change.
You know, James, I've got to agree with Chris here. Let's face it, for the kind of change that the people of Canada and the people of the world need to see, there's only two courses of action, really. One of them is a bloody and destructive violent revolution where people get killed, institutions fail, poverty and death for a lot of people, and until we pull the pieces together and build a new society. That's one option. The other option is to take back what's ours. Take back our political systems. Take back our banking systems. Regain our sovereignty. Now, I really do believe that the Canadian solution is not bloody revolution. I don't see that happening in Canada. I think first what we need to do is educate the population, make them aware of exactly what's going on, and let's face it, it is a criminal conspiracy. They tend to throw that conspiracy theorist label on a lot of people like us, but the truth of the matter is that there is a criminal conspiracy going on, and the people who are the elites in Canada are the ones behind it, and they're in league in this conspiracy with the elites of the rest of the world to put forth their own agenda, whether it's good for the populations of the world or not. I think in Canada, first we need to educate people, and the next logical step would be a radical revolutionary change in the politics of this country. Now, whenever a new political party has started to rise to the top on the Canadian political scene, I could only go to the example of the Reform Party in Preston Manning. When he was running against Sean Crutchin for Prime Minister of Canada, you know, it started out as a Western grassroots sort of thing, and it spread, and it was making very good headway into Toronto. And what happened was CSIS ended up pulling some dirty tricks, stuff that we should expect to see in politics. What they did is they started up a group of neo-Nazis and then signed them all up to the Reform Party. 3 weeks before the election, the headlines in the Ontario papers were Reform Party's full of Nazis. The outcome of that was that Preston Manning ended up losing official opposition status by one seat to the Bloc Québécois. There was a leadership change. The Conservatives, who'd done so poorly in that election, they only got three seats, ended up taking over the Reform Party under Stephen Harper. And, you know, that guy's Prime Minister today under the new Conservative Party, and the Reform Party just doesn't exist. They just literally moved in there and ate the Reform Party and took over their agenda. You know, they became the new Conservative Party, and by the time, you know, the next set of elections came up 4 years later, everybody had basically forgotten about Preston Manning, and they were now looking at Stephen Harper is the head of the Conservative Party. So, you know, what we need to do is we need to take back our political system. It's been hijacked by the banks and the elites with money. And the way to do that for me is by supporting the number five party in Canada, quickly becoming number four, the Canadian Action Party, and have faith that we could somehow one day bring people to power that are looking out for the best interests of Canadians and not the best interest of the bankers. Because the only other solution is bloody revolution, and nobody really wants that, do they?
Certainly not. Definitely not. I think there must be a better way. So I agree basically with the premise of both of you that education is the key, because I think people perish for lack of knowledge. And when they are informed about what the issues really are and who the enemies are and how they're lined up against us, I think the path forward becomes a lot more straightforward, and it's a lot easier when there are more of us who are aware of these issues. So on that note, I know there must be a lot of people. I know there are a lot of Canadians that listen to this, and I know that there are probably a lot of people in the audience right now who are contemplating whether or not to join in the protests and how best to do it. So if people are interested in joining in with the type of the ideas and ideals that you guys are talking about, how can they get in touch with you? And, you know, are you guys having your own organizational meetings or meetings of some sort to about how you're going to engage with the Occupy protests or what's going on in that regard?
Well, here in Victoria, I'm with a group. We're going to be at the legislative building. The General Assembly group has decided to go to the mayor's office. We believe that the power to this province is with the legislation and the legislative building. And so we're going to be there where it's our rights and it's our freedoms to express ourselves. And we encourage people to participate. Don't shy away because we're saying these are co-opted. It's, as Lawrence says, take them back. We can take them back. We can give the message that needs to be heard. We can find other Canadians that support real change, not just talk. We're talking real change. So let's participate. Feel free to get in touch with me through Facebook. Again, it's Christopher Porter, Canadian Action Party. Always feel free to give me a phone call as well, 250-999-VOTE, and always standing by to participate with people that believe and love this beautiful country of ours.
And here in Toronto, we'll be attending the protest with a small contingent of Canada Action Party members. We'll be handing out literature. You could contact us through our website, CanadaActionParty.ca. Join the party, get involved, and help the Canadian Action Party put forth its policies, which we believe are good for all Canadians, and promote the party. We'll be down there handing out literature. You could go to our website. You could join the party. Run for office. Be the change you want to see.
There you go.
You know,
exactly.
I always tell people, if you're not participating, you're spectating or speculating. And there's been enough people that speculated this great nation, and now it's at the point of that, and it needs our participation to make it the great Canada it truly is.
Or participation, as the old Canadian TV ads exactly. used to say. Yeah, right. Okay, excellent. Well, this is a huge, huge story, and it's still developing, so I think we'll leave it there for now, and hopefully we can get updates from you guys as these Occupy protests continue to spread, and we'll see how it develops. But an interesting conversation, and one that I hope that more people are starting to have as this develops into something quite major. So let's leave it there. Lawrence McCurry, Christopher Porter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, James.